have our guest, and our second guest for the day is Dr. Mark Bruce. He is an emergency room doctor who is going to talk about COVID-19, epidemic or pandemic. He is the ambassador to Belize in Canada for the American College of Emergency Physicians. And his recent book, which is very interesting, is titled Jackie, A Boy and a Dog, Cold War Story. And I believe it came out March 1st, I believe. Dr. Bruce, welcome to the program. Are you there?
Yeah, I am here. Can you should be here? Can you hear me?
Yes. Talk some more so we can.
I'm sorry. I had some audio problems there. I don't know what happened, but I'm here. Can you hear me now?
Great. I'm so happy to have you on the program. This has been, you say, is it an epidemic or a pandemic? And is this whole thing overblown? Are we looking for an epidemic, a pandemic, or what? What's going on here?
Yeah, Deanna, it really depends on where you are. First of all, I don't think we're at the pandemic stage yet. I think we need to be careful about how we use the words. Epidemic really is best defined as really a widespread occurrence of an infectious disease within a community at a particular point in time. So you go to China, I think it's clearly, and certain other parts, northern Italy, Iran, some of these other areas clearly are kind of at that epidemic stage where it really has created a lot of occurrence within a specific defined area at a specific time. Pandemic actually is a step above that, where that same process is involving an entire country or the entire global community. I don't think we're there yet. There's certainly the potential for that, not there. And certainly in the United States, the United States as a country certainly is not, I think, at an epidemic stage. There's certain pockets of the country, especially up in the Northwest and King County in the Seattle area. That's definitely a hot spot, a hot zone for COVID-19. It's more in targeted pocket areas where it's really a problem.
Now, I noted that that it seems like every election year there's a disease. Like in 2004, it was SARS. In 2008, it was avian. 2010, it was swine. 2012, it was MERS. 2014, it was Ebola. 2016, it was Zika or Zika. 2018, it was Ebola again. And now 2020, it's the Corona or the other name, COVID-19.
Yeah.
Isn't that so?
Yeah,
sort of,
and you know, I was over in Asia, the SARS epidemic, in late 2003 when it was really first kind of ramping up over there. So I had a firsthand view of that. You know, it's interesting that I think that all viral illnesses and the things that you mentioned basically are all viral illnesses. They do tend to have kind of cycles. Viruses, any virus is, even our regular influenza virus that we're all very familiar with, those we know mutate. And so they will kind of change, they'll kind of run a course. Typically what happens is that the population, we call it, herd immunity, they'll kind of build up some immunity to those particular viruses, that particular strain anyway, and then it's not much of a problem anymore, or it's at least recognized and contained. The challenge with something like this, COVID-19, is that it's a novel virus, which means it's new, And we, prior to December of 2019, we didn't know about it. It hadn't been recognized. So that's always the challenge in terms of their immunity and exposure to something that's new. It's always prone to producing some anxiety among the population, which is pretty normal if you're dealing with anything that's really in that unknown category.
There was one death in the Chicago area. I think you're in Wisconsin, aren't you, or no?
Yeah. Chicago's just 2 hours south of where I am.
Right. And there was one death in Chicago thus far, and yet we have all these people are afraid. I don't know. I think people probably, there are more snake bites during the same time period, or I'm more concerned about gun deaths and things that are different categories. I understand that, but they typically are designed to bring about perhaps a new vaccine, or are designed to make the population fearful. I don't know. I just have a lot of questions about it.
I think that's reasonable, Deanna. You know, it's a matter of perspective. And let me put it this way. Since October 1st of 2019, the CDC estimates that there's been between 18,000 and 45,000 influenza deaths in the United States, with probably more than 40 million people in the United States being affected, one out of eight people. So in comparison, and the other thing about COVID-19 is that most people that get it are going to do just fine. It does have the potential for creating problems, especially in an at-risk population. But you're right, I think part of it is that bad news sells. And there's no question that there's a potential political agenda going on here, and I don't think you can discount that.
Right. Even the CDC says on their website regarding influenza that their vaccine was really not effective, but people don't tend to read those kinds of things. They tend to just develop this fear. And as you also indicated, if your health is at risk for some other reason, maybe it's nutrition or you have something else going on where you're not in great health, then I think of course you're more at risk. But if you're relatively healthy and you have good hygiene, you wash your hands, I don't think everybody needs to go out and buy masks and do all the stuff that they're recommending. I think it does drive sales. It does drive people to demand a vaccine or to demand that the government take care of them. And if only one person in 7 or 8 million people die, that's just not anything that I'm going to worry about. More people die in the hospital, in a day than die in a month, wouldn't you say?
Well, exactly. I mean, again, to put this in perspective, there's 2,000 people in America today that are going to die of their heart disease. 2,000
right.
people today.
Right.
And so, you know, it kind of gets into this fear factor, this the fear of the unknown, and oh my gosh, you know, this is going to kill all of mankind. Well, it's not. And you know what you said about the vaccine is pretty much spot on. The average effectiveness for the influenza vaccines year after year is about 40% effective. They consider that acceptable. the current flu vaccine, they estimate that it was above average. It was at about a 46% rate of effectiveness. But we're still dealing with the second wave of the influenza that we're seeing, both influenza A and influenza B. And again, getting back to that, you know, between 18,000 and 45,000 people since October have died of influenza A or B.
Right.
Versus, you know, 14 deaths in the United States so far that have been confirmed. We know that number is probably going to go up because the virulence of this COVID-19 is certainly at a higher level than the virulence of your influenza A or influenza B. It's just because of the type of virus it is, the family of virus that it represents. It has an affinity for the lung tissue. It likes lung tissue. Whereas the influenza, parainfluenza, rhinoviruses that cause colds and the flu, those have an affinity for the upper respiratory tract, the nose and the throat and the bronchial tubes. And you know, once in a while, they can get into the lung and cause problems, which again accounts for a lot of the deaths that we've seen and that CDC has accounted for. But again, it's this fear factor. We have masks around our hospital. I work in an emergency department. I was on duty yesterday, and when I went on duty yesterday, I noted that we had little brackets that hold these masks outside of all the patient rooms. They were all empty. And I asked my nurse, I said, you know, where did all the masks go? She says, well, we took them away and put them in boxes in our stations and in your office because patients were grabbing them and taking them home. The whole stack of them and taking them home. So, you know, it's like our practice is when somebody comes in and they have respiratory symptoms, and we've been doing this throughout the flu season since last fall, is that we put a mask on them so that they don't droplet spread this to our staff or to other patients or to the visitors that are there. And so it's not a complete protective device, but it does limit the spread, especially droplet spread. So we continue to do that. And we take prudent precautions, sensible precautions, but not to the point of going crazy.
Right. And I think people need to understand how to breathe. I think a lot of people breathe through their mouth, which doesn't have a filtering system. You need to be breathing through your nose, which would filter out a lot of stuff that would then, if you breathe through your mouth, it's going to go into your lungs unfiltered. So.
And the nose also is a great way to hydrate, and that's another big problem associated with these respiratory illnesses is that the mucus and the airway becomes way, way too thick and tenacious because of that.
And also with vaccines, there are other adjuvants in the vaccines that aren't so good for people. Like for the multi-dose flu vaccine has mercury in it because they give like 20 shots out of one container. Is that right?
I really don't know how many doses are contained in the multi-dose vials. I can't answer or address that, Deanna.
Yeah. Anyway, I just, all this fear is, and the world just seems to be overreacting. Are we overreacting?
Well, the first rule of any epidemic is you protect the uninfected. And so I think what we saw in China was a tremendous underreaction. And that allowed the situation to get out of control. Whenever you have constraints that are placed on science or medicine for political purposes, it's a recipe for disaster. And that's exactly what happened in China. That's what happened in the United States during the early stages of the HIV crisis that we had here back in the 80s. Mm-hmm. There were political constraints in terms of who could be tested and getting consent and all that kind of stuff. And we're still dealing with the repercussions of that here now 30, 40 years later. Well, the same thing applied in China in the Wuhan area where this actually started. The local officials didn't want to look bad in the eyes of their superiors. So they said, oh, no, 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 we can handle this, when clearly this was beyond the scope of both their resources and expertise. When it started getting out of control, their superiors didn't want to look bad in the eyes of the world community. And so they kind of, again, did not employ the full resources that were available and the full protective measures that should have been taken in terms of, again, protecting the uninfected. And that's what really allowed this. And the big difference between the last, between the SARS outbreak back in the early 2000 and 2003, 2004, was that China was a very different country back then than what it is now. And the impact that they have on the world is much different now than what it was at that time. So that really amplified their lack of response significantly, even more so than what it was with SARS. So all of those things, you know, it's kind of multifactorial in terms of, you know, how we've ended up where we are at this point in time.
Given the trade deficiencies and the trade situation where the United States gets a lot of product from China, do you see this as being an issue or not?
Well, it will be an issue in terms of the global economy. I mean, we are in a global economy. I will tell you that, as it relates to this current situation, one very positive outcome from the trade war that we've had with China is that a lot of American companies, a lot of global companies, have basically moved a lot of their supply chain out of China into some of the other Asian countries, Vietnam, even Myanmar and Thailand, all those areas. India certainly has been a beneficiary of that. So if this had happened 3 years ago, prior to a lot of that shift, I think the impact would again have been much, much greater in terms of the economy and on business and supplies and all those types of things. Still, it's going to have a big effect because you just don't flip a switch and change everything. And if you're a business, it takes some time to kind of ramp up those type of resources and facilities. But I see that as a real positive that has developed because of the Trump policies that he's put in place, the trade policies with China.
Now, this COVID-19, was during the Chinese New Year, which a lot of people go to Asia and other parts of the world. Is this a factor in the spread or the so-called spread of this virus?
Oh, absolutely. I refer to this disaster as the result of a perfect storm. I've traveled in Asia many, many times during the Chinese New Year. It is the peak travel time of all of Asia and many of the areas around Asia where there's significant Chinese populations or Asian populations. As I mentioned before, in addition to that travel, because of that travel, people are going into and gathering in resource-limited environments. Either they're coming to or from those resource-limited environments for purposes of Chinese New Year. And that's kind of where this, all started. And not only that, on top of that, you've got these constraints that have been placed on the medicine and the science world by the Chinese government. And on top of that, you've got the American political system coming into a year of election, struggling to find the right voice to find a soft landing for this crisis.
Right. Dr. Bruce, we do need to cut to a quick 3-minute break. We'll be right back.
With you and me, it starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead.
All righty, welcome back. Our second guest today is Dr. Mark Bruce. He is an emergency room doctor, and we are talking about COVID-19. And you were talking about the perfect storm. And I recall that when I lived in Sacramento, California, that, gosh, everybody went to went to San Francisco, to Chinatown, because things were happening, and it was just, and I'm not Chinese, but it was just the place to be because there was all this excitement, and it was wonderful to participate in it and to eat the food and walk around in Chinatown. It was just great. And the same is for Chicago. There's Chinatown in Chicago, and it's just a perfect place to be during the Chinese New Year and during the, just to go there. It was just a really nice thing. But as you say, it did present a perfect storm.
Exactly. You're absolutely right. It's a wonderful celebration. There's nothing like celebrating Chinese New Year in Asia.
Right. And what better time to have a disease that people could.
Exactly.
Go to Asia, come home, and bring the virus with them.
It has happened, so.
Yes. And be stuck on a ship somewhere.
That's kind of, to me, I can't imagine. I was a Navy doctor for several years, and so I was on a naval vessel for about 7 months on an extended deployment. But, when you're planning to go on a week's vacation and all of a sudden that week turns into a month, that's got to be incredibly not only uncomfortable, but disrupt it to your whole life. You've got a schedule and things that you've got to get back to. And now all of a sudden you're in this, 300 square foot, cabin and instead of having the glamorous dinners, you're getting what can be supplied to the ship.
Right. And I think, probably, they're not getting fresh air. Sunshine. There are things that people can do to enhance their health. And I think too, I'm surprised that they were not using some of the traditional Chinese healing methods for this virus in China before it ever left.
Well, and Deanna, one of the things that is frustrating about this is that we don't really know exactly what they were doing. We have, I think it's not unreasonable to have serious questions about anything in terms of news that's coming out of China because of their lack of transparency. It's a closed society. It's not dissimilar to what we saw during the Soviet Union during before the Iron Curtain fell. I remember when I was in the Navy that we had a report in one of the outlying areas of the USSR that there had been an anthrax outbreak, and they blamed the Soviets blamed this anthrax outbreak on contaminated American beef that had been imported. Well, this anthrax outbreak took place in a community where there was a Soviet biologic factory.
Oh, yes.
And we knew that there was an explosion, and the only way that you can get pulmonary anthrax from beef is that you're snorting it. So, it was ridiculous. All of us that, were kind of privy to that secure information, just kind of had a chuckle about it. But, again, it kind of goes back to whenever you don't have, when you do have a closed society and a lack of transparency, it fosters some very appropriate suspicion and either over or under reaction depending on what the situation is.
Now, I know that just talking with people who have been to China recently, that they've really cleaned up their environment. When I was there in 2007, particularly in Beijing and highly populated areas, that you could barely breathe because of all of the a lot of smog from production, and you had by noon you had to wear a mask, and so it just seems rather odd to me that in as much as they've cleaned up their environment, that somehow they now have this virus. If they were going to have a virus, it seems like it would have happened when the country was really not protecting their environment from production with all
well,
the smog.
Well, they still do have a fair amount of pollution issues. I mean, they were burning a lot of coal for their power plants, and they haven't been able to kind of completely get themselves off of that. And there still is a pollution issue. You're right, it's getting better. There's a tremendous move afoot to electrify the country in terms of their automobiles. And you have a lot of efforts going into that. And there is certainly, I think the Chinese government wants to look very good in the world, in the world's eyes in terms of being accepted as really a team player in terms of, you know, environmental issues and things like that with the other big countries around the world. This has been a real black eye for them in that regard, because clearly everybody recognized that they dropped the ball on this.
So how do you treat this? How different is it from other similar things that might affect the respiratory tract, which you've already talked about a little bit?
Well, the things that don't work with this are, you know, antibiotics are generally not going to be very helpful. So a lot of the therapy that we have for patients that are very ill with this is support, what we call supportive therapy. You want to optimize air exchange. You want to optimize as best you can the lung function, especially once they get pneumonia. There's a lot of ways that you can do that with positive pressure ventilation. Some medications, some antiviral medications have really not proven very effective because this virus in particular is a little bit unique. Like I say, it's a novel virus and it's still being studied. So we're still getting more and more information about it. We know that this virus, even unlike some of the other coronavirus family members, can spread into the blood and can spread into the urine and can spread into the feces and not just be droplet spread. We don't know if it's transmissible in those body fluids, those other body areas, but that's an area of concern and study still at this point in time. So the other, you know, SARS and MERS, there's four other strains of the coronavirus family that are less virulent than those, but these are the big three. The other two, MERS and SARS, really didn't do that. But again, we know that the virus is there, but we don't know if it's active and if it can be spread. The big risk in terms of this virus in transmissibility is droplet spread. So you want to, again, you certainly do the things to optimize people that are at risk. You know, people need to optimize their health in general, but particularly with this, particularly with a respiratory infection, a lower respiratory infection, a pneumonia, the people that smoke, they're going to really substantially increase their risk just by using tobacco on a regular basis. So this is a great time to quit smoking. I mean, it sounds a lot easier to say than do, and I know it's a very, very challenging issue. But at the same time, the return on that investment of effort is tremendous. And especially in terms of whenever, it's not going to make you sick from getting this disease, but if you do get it, you're going to have a rougher time with it if you're a tobacco smoker.
Wow. Smoking is a really bad choice to begin with. It's but antibiotics really don't work with this.
Yeah, for any viral infection, you know, I tell people the things that are going to help and boost your immune response are certainly, like you mentioned before, fresh air, aerobic exercise. If you're running a fever, you don't really want to go out and exercise. But if you're not running a fever and just kind of keeping in good shape, all of those things. But if you do start getting sick, things that boost immune response, even simple things like vitamin C and chicken soup, we don't know why, but those things do help. And I'm a big fan of whatever helps.
Right. Yeah, I think people should take vitamin C every day. Just be taking it because it is good for your immune system.
Right.
Now you talk about the demographics, and which demographic group is most vulnerable. And such as a flu, the only time I ever got the flu, was probably quite a while ago, maybe 15 years, and it was right after I got a flu shot. I thought, well, I'm not gonna ever do that again, because I think it just seemed like one caused the other, and so I take vitamin C. I take a lot of vitamin C and other vitamins. I think vitamins are good. Taking care of your immune system. Would you agree, or?
Yeah, I would. Good nutrition in general, eating a good diet. Quite frankly, if you're eating well, eating a good fresh food prepared properly, you know, if you're doing that and well-balanced diet, you probably don't need vitamin supplements. But if you're not, and quite frankly, most of us don't, you know, then that's good advice. I know a lot of people promote and tout the value of using zinc in particular. So those are things that I don't have a lot of good scientific data to point to in terms of their effectiveness. But those are out there, and like I said, I like things that I'm a big fan of whatever works.
All right.
But you're right. In terms of antibiotic therapy, we've really created a lot of problems with overuse of antibiotics, especially in treating viral illnesses, because it has created issues with drug resistance. It's created a lot
right.
of issues with antibiotic-associated diarrheas. Some of them are very, very toxic. I actually had an uncle who died of that. He was getting some antibiotics and ended up with a very, very bad enterocolitis, a bad colitis associated with the antibiotics that he was on, and he died from that. So I'm particularly sensitive to that. And so I think that we are a lot more, as providers, healthcare providers, I think we are promoting antibiotic stewardship a lot more, being sure that we are treating a bacterial infection before we write that prescription for an antibiotic. Because like I say, in the setting of a viral infection, they're not going to be effective. But the one caveat to that is many times viral illnesses can cause a change in the body's immune response.
Right.
So what starts out as a viral infection can then morph into a bacterial infection, at which point in time, then yes, antibiotic therapy is certainly indicated.
Right. But really, an antibiotic for a virus does not work, and it does, it creates yeast, and it just seems like if you take your child in for an ear problem, that they get an antibiotic.
Yes and no. I will tell you that I know a lot of my pediatrician friends. The United States is one of the few countries in the world that does that, Deanna. The rest of the world, whenever they see a child with a middle ear infection, or what we call an otitis media, which is kind of the typical ear issue that a lot of kids have, that parents bring them to the urgent care, their family doctor, or even the emergency department, many times in the middle of the night because the kid's kind of crabby and crying, maybe have a fever, and you look at the ear, and yeah, it looks like it's red, and there's a little bit of what we call an effusion or some bulging of the middle ear that we are, by default, the United States are typically going to prescribe an antibiotic for that. The rest of the world doesn't do that nearly as much, and they will opt to just watch and wait. And many times, when you look at large outcomes of patients afflicted by that problem, outcomes are about the same whether you treat with an antibiotic or whether you don't. There's a couple of exceptions to that. We have developed the issue because of liberal use of antibiotics, of the drug resistance and antibiotic-associated diarrheas that I mentioned. The rest of the world has much more of an issue with meningitis and mastoiditis related to untreated otitis medias. But again, in large groups, outcomes are very, very similar.
Interesting.
So many of my, that's what I was getting to, is that many of my pediatric friends now are telling me that they will, when they see a child that comes into their office with an otitis media, an ear infection, they will say, okay, look, here's the prescription, but please don't fill it for a day or two. And just use some either Tylenol or ibuprofen, those type of things for either fever or pain, which are very effective. And let's see how it goes over the next day or two. And if they're getting worse, then go fill the prescription. So that's kind of more and more, that's happening more and more. My practice, I will tell you, is because I'm an emergentologist. I work in the hospital in the emergency department. I see a sicker patient than what is typically seen in an office setting. So I'm much more likely in that setting to go ahead and start the patient on an antibiotic.
Right. People don't generally go to the emergency room unless it is what they feel is an emergency. Yes. Makes sense. Otherwise, you would probably say, put some heat on it, have them lay on a warm, you know, a heating pad or something. And
exactly.
Right. Huh. Now, this has created a political situation. And there's also some questions about whether or not this outbreak was created by a Chinese biolab. What are your feelings or understanding of that?
Well, I know Senator Tom Cotton from Arkansas basically brought this up, and I, and he's correct. There is a biolab in the Wuhan area. I don't think it's unreasonable to kind of question the proximity of that lab to this animal market, the wet market, basically, where the cases were first attributed to. All I can tell you is that, again, this lack of transparency, this closed society that China represents, does foster those type of questions. We just don't know. And I don't think it's unreasonable to ask whenever you have that. And similar to the situation, like I mentioned, in Russia back in the early 80s. So it was, we know exactly what happened there because, you know, we had good intelligence on the ground, but not so much in China these days, so.
Huh. I remember when you mentioned anthrax, who was it? Was it, ex-governor of Pennsylvania was appointed as the new Homeland Security.
I think it was Tom Ridge.
And there were people who were supposedly getting these envelopes filled with the anthrax, and he made an announcement, oh, don't worry about that anymore. There's not going to be any more. Well, how would he know that? And why would he make that, announce that? It just made it seem like, well, how would he know that they're not sending any more out to sea? Was he in charge of sending them out, or was it something that was developed in some bio lab somewhere, all of a sudden he knew that they weren't going to be getting any more? Sounds kind of fishy to me.
Yeah, a lot of unknowns, a lot of things that go on that we really don't understand or know, but kind of like I was listening to your advertisement before this current segment, you know, knowledge is power. And that's why it is so important to be well informed and to educate yourself and to not be afraid to question you know, things that especially the mainstream media is putting out there. So
right, and that is what you hear on the nightly news. They just seem to be ramping this up, and they tell you all about what you should be doing and how terrible it is, and then they say, oh, in Chicago, one person has died. Well, Chicago has probably, 7 million people in it? And one person dies?
Yeah, the suburban areas, correct?
Yes. I'm more concerned about all the shootings that take place. They don't particularly talk about that, but one death, and they're going to devote all this time on the news? It just seems a little... Go ahead.
You certainly don't, you know, the loss of life is regrettable no matter where it occurs, but again, it's a matter of perspective. And again, you have to kind of keep in mind, okay, where is this? Everybody's got a bias. I mean, we all do. And it's just a matter of being honest about your bias and straightforward. And that's the insidious thing, I think, about what we see now is that a lot of the mainstream media is not really forthcoming or honest about their own bias.
Oh, that's so true. And it seems like every station is talking about the same thing, and the number of news outlets has diminished considerably over the last 30, 40 years, so that the population is getting the same story, which seems to the media is definitely using scare tactics, which is rather irritating to me. I have been sick. I have a lung issue, I've learned to treat it, and it's gotten probably 90% better than it was. And I'm not unfamiliar with lung issues.
You know, it's interesting that a lot of these political situations that we have really, I was hopeful, you know, in the early stages of the Trump administration that, and I think that President Trump really understood this, that the value of relationship and how things can really improve through relationship. And during the early months of his administration, he was meeting with the head of state of China at Mar-a-Lago. And there were very, very hopeful steps, but then it kind of stalled and stopped. We saw a lot of the same, again, it's almost like history repeating itself back in the early part of the Kennedy administration with John Kennedy and Premier Khrushchev meeting at the 1961 Vienna Summit Conference.
Right.
And that was the beginning, even though the United States did not come out of that smelling real good. I mean, they really got rolled by Kennedy's performance there, and he admitted that. But it was the start of a relationship, and there was some concrete steps that they took to really develop a relationship. And that's where meaningful change often will occur, is really through a relationship. And so Khrushchev gave the Kennedy family, and this is kind of a little bit about them, about where my story in terms of the book that I wrote that was just released last week. Khrushchev gave the Kennedy family a space pup, whose mother, Strelka, had just come back from space alive and had a litter of pups. That gift of state was Pushinka. It was a little white dog. And, it was a gift to the Kennedy family and a token of friendship between Khrushchev and Kennedy. And that paid incredible dividends. A year and a half later, in the fall of 1962, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, where they had this relationship, and just those steps to develop the relationship can go an awful long way in terms of dealing with political crises. So fast forward into 63, that's whenever Pushinka had four pups that were sired by Charlie, the Kennedy's Welsh Terrier, and that was the dog that Jackie and John Kennedy gave me.
Oh, yes. Amazing. I think, too, you're right. When people get together and realize, hey, we're just two individuals and we have all this responsibility, and the more that we understand, the more that government leaders could and should understand other people, I think the less antagonism there would be, of course. What a story that is. That is really a very touching, wonderful story. And I hope that the book sells very well, because I think it has a real message there that when people look at each other as people, as individuals, and understand relationships, I think that's the first step towards diminishing warfare and all this other nonsense that goes on. Alrighty. Oh, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Alrighty, we are back. And our guest this last hour has been Dr. Mark Bruce. And we are talking about the COVID-19, whether it's an epidemic or a pandemic. And during the break, I was thinking the Chinese have an ancient tradition of healing people. Well, they've been using what they would call traditional Chinese medicine to heal themselves of all kinds of situations, of problems. And I'm surprised that they're not relying on those methods. And I just when I was there, I noticed the strength of these people. As we were on this cruise down the the Yangtze River, I saw people that were Chinese gentlemen who were lifting rocks that were probably as heavy as they were. And I thought, my gosh, how does this small statured individual lift so much weight? They seem to be so strong. They would pack their bicycles with pounds and pounds of things, and some of the way that they were traveling in carriages, and they just seemed like a very, very strong people.
I think they are. To your point, Deanna, we really don't know exactly what they've been doing in terms of treating the illness, you know, this COVID-19 there. We don't
right.
know how much faith to really put in really what they're telling us.
And, oh, right.
It's a difficult situation to really discern exactly what's going on.
Right. And also the number of people who run the government is much, it's just a teeny, teeny fraction of the population there. So we really have no idea.
That's exactly right. And we have some good Chinese friends, and they tell us that they still have a lot of contact back with friends in the mainland area. They live in the area here. But, you know, there is increasing mistrust of the central government, that it is not all that it seems to be. So,
right.
There's no question that there's more than meets the eye.
Right. Well, I just the Chinese people seem to be. My dentist is Chinese, and we've just had a lot of chats and whatnot. But yes, it just seems there's something weird about this whole situation. And it would be interesting to know where this was created, if it was created, whether it's being used to put fear into us, or political. There's a number of reasons why they would be doing this. I think.
Exactly.
And it's just up to us. And as you indicated, the people, I believe you indicated this, that the people that have it should be the ones to wear the mask. The rest of us should be out walking and breathing and taking care of ourselves so that we can avoid.
You know, one of the things, exactly. I mean, if you're around somebody who's coughing, you probably, you know, take a few steps away. When somebody
sure.
sneezes, that aerosolizes their droplet spread for
right.
a radius of about 6 or 8 feet.
Wow.
If I'm in a grocery store and somebody sneezes, I'll tell you what my practice is. I take about 2 or 3 steps, and then I take my next breath. So
yes, great idea. Wonderful idea. All righty.
You do the things that your mom told you to do. You wash your
right.
hands a lot. You cover your mouth when you cough. Sensible precautions.
Right. Well, thank you so very much for being on the program today. Bless your heart.
It's been good to talk to you, Deanna.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, listeners. Chat with you next week. Take care. Have a wonderful week.